Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today's episode is brought to you by Toro. Golfers get custom fit clubs for longer, straighter shots. Now using the adjustable technology on Toro's new Greenmaster 1000 Series Walk Green Mower, superintendents can dial in operator performance for precise, consistent cuts. The Greenmaster's telescoping handle has five different positions, so the operator's posture will be as perfect as a tour pro's, whether he's tall and skinny or short and husky. And the handle's rubber mounts have just enough cushion to prevent any hand movements from influencing the cut. Sounds like Toro solved the mower yips. Maybe they can fix the putting yips next. Follow at Toro Golf on Twitter and reach out to your local Toro distributor to schedule a demo. We are back for another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today, I was joined by superintendent at Cedar Rapids Country Club, Tom Feller. Tom is a great guy. He's been there for just about 18 years now and has done a ton of work transforming Cedar Rapids since he got there. They've made huge strides. Recently, were noted on a list of the five best restoration projects in the last few years that I saw on golf.com. Tom joins us. We talk about a ton of stuff, his background, how he got into it, and then his work at Cedar Rapids and some of the unique things they've done from tree management to also flood management and just his general kind of practices. So, you know, again, a special thanks to Toro for making this superintendent series possible. Excited by everybody's support and positive messages about the first one with Alex Beeson-Crone that aired last month. We'll continue to have this be a monthly thing, and we're excited to interview more and more superintendents here. So without further ado, here is Tom Feller.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
What'd you have for breakfast this morning?
I don't eat breakfast.
Really?
No.
I have
a 16-hour fast until lunch.
No way.
Daily, yes.
What time's lunch?
11 to 12.
So you get your full hour in.
Yes.
What do you drink coffee then in the morning?
I do drink coffee. Coffee and water.
Coffee and water.
Yes.
It's like so you only eat lunch and dinner.
Exactly.
Really works for you, huh?
I'm not sure it works for me, but I'm doing it.
People say breakfast is the most important meal of the day.
Maybe.
Do you like breakfast food?
Not necessarily.
No?
No. Man. Eggs just don't agree with me. So, you know, I walk by it every morning to get my coffee in the convenience store and pass right past the egg biscuit.
So you get coffee at the convenience store every every morning?
Every morning.
Same one?
Same one.
Roughly the same time.
At roughly the same time. It changes a little bit in the wintertime.
Okay. So they know you there.
They do know me there, okay. Yes. It's a block from my house. I should make it at home, but it's just too easy to stop and get.
Yeah, it saves you 10 minutes.
For sure it does, yeah. And
at that time in the morning.
Yep.
You're spending what you would be eating for breakfast.
Exactly right.
So how often do you walk the golf course?
During the season, at least three times a week. I find that it just, first of all, it gets me some exercise, which I enjoy. I can kind of follow up my staff in the morning as they go out, check on things. I can check on what is happening that's going right and what's happening that's going wrong, basically.
You have like a time that you walk?
I do. So normally we'll start the crew. My assistant will start the crew, and then I'll normally go out like 6:30. And I'll change it up, but a lot of times I go backwards. because I follow up on what they've gotten accomplished in the morning.
Okay, so you'll go walk 18
backwards. And go backwards.
And you're looking at what they're doing and then other stuff.
Exactly. And then kind of, you know, helping my assistants line up the second job for the day.
What's one thing that you've noticed on like one of these walks that sticks out?
You know, it's amazing just even the simple things that don't get accomplished. You know, you tell your T-service crew or T-service man or woman to fill the divots and pick up the T's and clean up the entire T complex, and you find that they're just filling half the divots. Or you follow up your pin setting guy and, you know, you tell him that, you know, I recommend 10 to 12 feet from the collar, but it's got, you know, he's 8 feet from the collar on some certain pins. So you notice things that just you wouldn't notice just on a quick drive around on the golf course. Basically, it's daily setup, I would say, more than anything.
Mm-hmm. Nothing ever like really big.
Nothing earth shattering, no.
Uh-huh. No. But it gives you a feel for the golf course, right?
It does. I mean, I enjoy just I enjoy walking just because of, you know, I love setup. You know, the morning setup, the tee blocks set perfectly, the rakes and the bunkers, you know, where they're set around the bunker. You know, there's a set arrangement for everything that we have, and it's just kind of nice to follow up with those kind of things.
What's your set arrangement for the bunkers?
Typically, the rakes go parallel to the fairway,
okay,
and outside the bunker.
Outside.
Outside, and they should, and normally they'll be on, you know, the outside edge of the fairway. So
I feel like that's kind of a big hot topic.
It is. I would agree.
Everybody does it a little different.
And along with your membership, mm-hmm, regardless of the rule. They will leave them in the bunker, out of the bunker, or across the fairway. It just depends on what kind of shot they hit.
Is that your pet peeve, the bunker rake leaving, the way they leave bunkers?
No, my biggest pet peeve, and all the people that have worked for me will say, it's how to set the tee blocks up. Every time we set up tee blocks, and every time I'm on the tee, I will at least move a third of the tee blocks, because I just like to change the setup from day to day. And a lot of times they'll either move them like a foot or two in front or a foot or two in back. And so the guys that are playing every day, I would rather have them play a different golf course every day than the same yardage from day to day.
I agree with that. So like you move them drastically different.
I do. And even just sometimes a set different tees. I mean, just to change the setup.
I think that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah. You know,
what's the most crazy you've gotten? Have you ever moved a back tee in front of a different tee?
I've moved a back tee all the way to the forward tee. So it'll play from 155 and it will drop down to 110. And as long as it, you know, from the handicap standpoint, as long as you're the same with the other tee blocks, I think you're okay.
So that all the other tee box would have to move up.
Move up for also, yep.
That's, I like that.
Yeah, I just like changing it up. And my assistants always give me such a hard time because they'll go set up. I'll even have them set up and they'll get in and then I'll come in, you know, an hour later after you walk on the course and they'll be like, well, how many blocks did you move? So it's just one of my biggest pet peeves.
One of the best things is to have day-to-day variety.
I agree.
And it's amazing because people are creatures of habit. They just hate change. Do you ever get members that push back when you move something way up?
Well, we've had comments on it. Like, must, you know, either, you know, especially on tee blocks, if you move them to a different tee, they'll be like, well, it must have had a new guy start today. Where I was the one that did it, you know. Uh-huh. Those type of things. But the pin places are what they really get. You know, if you get kind of crazy with the pin placements from day to day, they'll comment on that, how it must have been a bad night last night for the superintendent, you know.
Everybody's always got an opinion.
Exactly.
And most people that are members of country clubs are very successful in life, so they, you know, they're used to being the opinion that matters most in most of their life's activities.
I would agree with that 100%. So,
how did you get into turf and becoming a golf super? Were you a golfer growing up? Or
so I grew up in small town Iowa, northeast corner of Iowa, in Waukon, and we grew up a block away from the 9-hole golf course that was in town, and I basically was the superintendent's nightmare up there. I was out at 6:30 in the morning playing in the dew, wondering why the greens weren't cut, wondering why he aerified greens one day. So I started with that, and then went from, you know, the time when I played high school golf from my freshman year on, and then worked in a city park just for something to do. And so I just loved working outside. And I started working in the park when I was 15 and worked actually till my second year of college, till I moved out of Waukon, and just enjoyed being outside, and actually was going to teach. And so I was going to Winona State University for as a math major, and got to my final in my third year, through my third year, to where I had to sign up for student teaching and decided I didn't want to do it. And so actually I just heard about this turf program down in Myrtle Beach or in Conway, South Carolina. And so decided to pick up and bolt down to South Carolina and attend Horry Georgetown Technical College.
Ah, yeah. You were always an early riser.
Always an early riser.
Being now where you were the person that was out with the crew early and, you know, wondering why stuff wasn't mowed and everything, in terms of how you would communicate with membership that wants to get out early or golfers, say you were a public course and golfers that want to get out early and push, what kind of effect does that have on your crew if you're, you know, being disrupted?
Yeah, I won't say what it has to do with the crew as much as what it has to do with the membership, because they're just not getting, they're not getting the conditions that they deserve if we're getting pushed on the golf course too early. So, you know, they're out playing and the bunkers aren't getting raked. We can't stay ahead of them with the greens more. You know, when I lived in Myrtle Beach, I worked at a resort course called Arcadian Shores. And I mean, we were one hole ahead of the golfers every morning that we worked there. And they just don't get the quality. You just don't get the quality that they deserve, is the way I feel. Now, I realize there's a definite revenue base there versus, you know, we have a dues base. So it's like, for a private club, I think you deserve better.
And for some people, if they're like, they got stuff going on at home, they're just, the mission of the round early in the morning is just to get done as fast as possible.
Absolutely. And we still have trouble. I mean, they start at 6:30 here on Saturday mornings, and we'll have guys get done at 9.
So you guys are starting in the dark.
Oh, yeah.
Like 4
5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And we run off the front and back just to keep ahead of them.
Mm-hmm. How long did you live in Myrtle Beach then?
I was there 2 years.
That's how was working down there? Did you then come back up to?
I did. So I went from Myrtle Beach to Quincy Country Club in Quincy, Illinois.
Yeah. So what was it like, you know, with Bermuda and obviously, you know, Myrtle Beach, the probably most rounds per capita of any place in the world?
Yeah, it was crazy. First of all, I was there when Hurricane Hugo came through. So we had, you know, 1,000 trees that went down. I mean, it was a whole different ball game. The first year I was there was prior to Hugo. And, you know, it was a little more enjoyable, I would say. But you still are dealing with Bermuda. We had old Pencross bentgrass greens that were just struggled. You know, you had issues, salt issues in the water. And Bermuda was basically just such a weed. I mean, that's what I figured it was. You know, weed edge bunkers, and they had, I might have this number wrong, but I should know it. It had over 80 bunkers, and they were huge bunkers. And you get done edging them, and you just turn around and start edging them again. It was the most defeating deal on the whole golf course, defeating job.
So you were there the 2 years you were getting the degree. You were working, correct, and you were going to school at the same time.
Yes.
What kind of, like, what was your schedule like then? Early morning, then you'd go to school after you're done, or?
The beauty of their program is they basically had you in a job before you even had your class schedule. So you would get your job, and then you'd work your class schedule around it. I had quite a few credits already when I got down there, so I really had a pretty easy life down there as far as school went. So I worked 30 hours a week. And then went to school also, you know, but the job experience is huge. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think they really stress that. And, you know, I work for a superintendent assistant down there. The assistant was from Storm Lake, Iowa. So that was kind of our connection. So a lot of the Iowa guys went to that golf course. So it was kind of cool.
As somebody now that hires, you know, young assistant superintendents, different, how do you value education versus, you know, the versus, you know, on the job training versus, you know, because obviously you've got superintendents that run the gamut of technical 2-year degrees to, you know, master's.
Sure. You know, I wouldn't put, you know, I had a 2-year degree and then I went and finished my 4-year degree just from a Marquis, just for my own professional. I just wanted to do it, just to have it. And I would encourage guys now to get their 4-year degree just because of the market the way it is. But really, from my standpoint, for an assistant, you know, you want them to have at least, I would want them to have at least a 2-year degree, but having the work ethic is what I'd really be looking for, and being willing to learn. I mean, that's really what I look for. It's not the guy that just wants to come in for 40 hours a week and collect his paycheck and not be able to broaden his horizons a little bit and not see the big picture. I mean, I just want somebody that really wants to dive in, enjoy what they do, and learn to be able to move on.
What, how's, you've been here for 18 years. How's the hiring and labor changed in that time?
You know, I've, from my standpoint, I haven't had too many issues. We've always had, I guess I've always had a good assistant base, and always have had, through my kids through the high schools have always brought me help, it seems like. So I've utilized them. They're those two, both my son and daughter, as a resource to get into the public or into the, you know, public school system. And once you get it moving and they enjoy their job, and it just seems like they just want to keep coming in. So I've really been fortunate. I mean, I haven't had, up here especially, I haven't had any issues with labor.
Yeah, I mean, what a job. Outside, I catted growing up, and I would work. The superintendent of the course I grew up at was always trying to get me to do the grounds thing, but I was caddying and working bagroom. But, I mean, it's nothing like being on a golf course early in the morning, you know?
It's the best way to start your day. And like, and I'm flexible with the staff. You know, I hire enough guys that you can, you know, they got to go on a summer vacation. You know, they're going to have a long weekend to do things. So I'm flexible as long as we can have coverage for when they're gone. And we make it enjoyable. I mean, I know a lot of the staff that comes in. I enjoy them because they come from all, you know, all different backgrounds, and they're going to college or going to be engineers or going to be doctors. They got all different types of, you know, professions they're going to go into. So it's really kind of fun to see them move on in life also.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be the seasonality though is tough because then they go back to school and
it is
probably still need work and.
For sure. I mean, that's one of the tougher things. Our, you know, like the last couple of years, our spring and fall have been such a disaster. It seems like, you know, late spring, early fall. So, you know, you haven't noticed it as much from a playing standpoint. I don't think the membership has known it. You know, I do, but we don't even have any golfers because, you know, the high has been 40 and the lows are 20. So it's like, you just don't notice it. But on a normal season, we definitely need more seasonal help, you know, mm-hmm. the shoulder seasons, especially
when you go from, you know, full staff in the summer and you say you lose your high school kids and you're a little shorter. What are the areas of maintenance that go from like that are the nice to haves that get kind of cut?
Definitely, you know, bunkers are probably number one. I mean, mm-hmm. we go from raking them every day to raking them twice a week. You know, we're spinning them with a bunker rake versus hand raking them. We go from walk mowing greens to ride mowing. You know, I'd say those are the things that I notice the most. And especially with the green complexes that we have, when you put a rider on them, you almost have to just back up and mow and back up and mow. You can't really turn on them. Mm-hmm. So otherwise it's caused too much damage to the collars. So you just notice some damage around collars. You know, you give up a little bit of the quality when you definitely get to that time of the year.
I imagine it's a little bit tougher to get it all the way out to the corners, too.
Absolutely.
Right?
Exactly.
So you run the risk of a little shrink.
Right. So in the spring, every year in the spring, we get out and cut them back out, get things back out to the edge.
How do you keep track of where they were? Do you like have them mapped, or is there a way that...
I just mark them. I mean, I just go back out, and I do it probably 4 times a year with this paint.
Well, you're walking all the time.
And I see it. You know, I'm very active on the golf course. Uh-huh. I mean, I love being out there and seeing.
Do you play a lot?
I don't. But I would like to again. At some point, I'm going to.
mentally, you could play while you're walking.
Yes, I could.
It's probably the best way to play golf.
Yeah, I think I've played, I think I played five times last year. So, yeah. And I played here twice. So, I enjoy going other places and playing. But I find myself, when I play here, it's just too much work. And that's just, all I do is think about, can't believe we missed that. I can't believe, you know, it's good for you, but it's also, if, when I play golf, I like to enjoy the game. And I like to look at, you know, I love to go to other courses and see what they're doing and get the full experience.
Yeah. I mean, it's beneficial in the sense of like seeing how the playing surface is reacting, right?
Exactly.
And how different things are working.
Mm-hmm. I would agree.
And then, but then going and seeing other people's stuff's good too, right?
There's so many good superintendents around and so many good clubs. I mean, you know, you never get around to all of them, but the connection we have with everybody, and what's nice about our profession is they always welcome you in. So, you know, you can make a phone call to them and say, hey, do you care if I come out and see your property and play it? And they're like, you know, just like I am to them. You know, I love to have them in.
Do you talk a lot with superintendents in the area?
I do.
And then you help each other out.
Oh, for sure. We even, you know, especially in town and around town, we share equipment a lot of times. But just advice on what people have done. And, you know, with social media these days, you know, everybody's on Twitter and Instagram. You can see a lot of what's going on. If you notice something that find interesting, I just call them and say, hey, can you elaborate a little bit more on what you're doing with this?
What's an example of that?
Well, you know, it's everything. It's just even ways guys airify fairways these days and drag the cores. And I mean, I saw some guy, I think it was Rick Tegmaier in Des Moines, who's using pallets for a drag mat versus a steel drag mat because he said it was less aggressive. It's just simple little things that you wouldn't think of doing, you know? Mm-hmm.
Did you start using the pallet?
I did not, but we didn't get our fairways airified yet this fall either. Uh-huh. So
it's interesting.
It is.
I imagine in terms of Twitter's change and social media's change the superintendent industry a ton, right?
Exactly.
Because it's one of those, you know, people lament social media so much, but the ability to share and spread information and knowledge is at an unparalleled height now.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I scroll through it and you do it in the evenings when you're just kind of bored anyway and you just roll through it and find something interesting, and it's amazing what you can pick out.
Do you go to like the GIS show?
I do.
Every year?
Every year.
And then you get to meet all your new internet friends.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. Well, I know most of them. I've been in the business for 30 years. So it's like.
That's what my wife's like, who are you talking to? I'm like, oh, just an internet friend. It's become like a normal thing. It's wild though.
It is. It really is. Yeah.
It's cool because I see it. You learn so much. Like there are all these, you know, accounts that pop up and all the old photos, and then you see the way people are doing it, experimenting with grass types in different parts of the country. And it's really unbelievable because, you know, now there's a way to see, oh, this guy's trying this. We were thinking about this.
Correct.
And this guy's trying this or this, you know, and oh, here, I can just shoot him a message and see how it's going before you try it and maybe waste a bunch of time.
Right. I would agree 100%. Yeah. It definitely makes it easier.
Yeah. Yeah. So when you were at Quincy, did you start as assistant there?
I did.
Your way up?
I was the assistant for 2 years under Randy Van Fleet. And then Randy left for Merrill Hills. And then they promoted me to the superintendent.
Merrill Hills in Wisconsin?
In Waukesha.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was there this year.
Oh, right? Yeah.
That's a cool property.
It is. He's been there, a long time now. Heck, he's been there 26 years probably.
I'm trying to figure out who designed that golf course. It's not Langford, but it's very Langford-esque.
Is it? Okay, yeah. I've only been on it one time, and that was early when he first moved up there.
I don't know. It could be like Harry Smead or Joe Roseman. I know, but it's that place got a ton of potential. It's neat.
Oh, that's cool.
You should go out there next time you're in the area.
Check it out.
Now for a quick word from our sponsor. Can you imagine a world where, you know, when you were playing golf, you'd be going down the fairway and there'd be hoof prints all over? I mean, maybe this happens at some courses where they got a lot of wildlife, but this was a common practice back in the early 1900s. Until 1919, Toro built the first motorized fairway mower. It replaced the horse-drawn equipment. And the big thing was it saved a ton of time. So it cut all 18 fairways in only 18 hours. Imagine that. Like, basically a summer day, you get all the fairways cut. That was all that could get cut. I bet they didn't get cut every day then. But as they've kept innovating, they've pushed these agronomic advancements in the industry forward. And today, you know, we're in the golden age of golf maintenance. And much of that's thanks to the innovative turf maintenance equipment and irrigation technologies that have been pushed by Toro. So be sure to follow at Toro Golf on Twitter. They've got a lot of cool stuff there. If you're into maintenance, obviously, if you're a superintendent, it should be a must follow. But if you're into maintenance and machines and just seeing how kind of an inside look behind the scenes of what goes on at the golf course, maybe when you're not playing golf, I highly recommend following their Twitter feed. If you're a superintendent, be sure to reach out to your local Toro distributor to demo the newest innovations from Toro. Now back to Tom Feller. What was it like going from assistant to head superintendent at a club versus your experience when you went from Quincy here as moving from head to head? What was different about that experience?
I think time just flew going from assistant to superintendent because I was so young. I was 26 when I got the job, and I felt like I was just really, in my mind, I was ready for it, but really I didn't have the experience. So I was learning on the fly a lot of times, and my poor assistant Tim now is the superintendent down there. So he's dealing with a lot of my, he's finding a lot of things that I did, but I said, just remember how early in my career that was. But you know, Quincy was very supportive of everything we did. And, you know, we didn't really change a lot of things. We didn't go in through any real restoration. We did a lot of cleanup and, you know, we redid bunkers, but it was just taking sand out, retiling them and putting the sand back in. So there wasn't, it's like we were making changes, architectural changes to the course. So, it was a good job, but I'm definitely a better planner after I moved here. Definitely learned a lot. It was, you know, it was a whole different ball game coming from superintendent to my second job versus the assistant to the superintendent.
I mean, what was something that you look back and laugh about, like that you, something you did that or a process you had that like
some of the drain tile I did was just horrendous, but, just way too shallow. And yeah, I look back, I'm like, kid, and he's ripping some of that up right now. So I'm hearing it from him. I'm like, oh, I hope he doesn't find that.
Yeah, a superintendent I know said that he ran into a superintendent that had been at the club he was at like 40 years earlier, and the first thing the guy said was, "I'm sorry, I have to apologize. I'm sorry." And he's like, "For what?" And he's like, "I planted 4,000 silver maples." He's like, "It was my first job. I didn't know what I was doing." The club president said, "Plant these," and I planted them.
Well, and we had a tree nursery, which the club already had probably 1,500 silver maples. So I don't know why we needed a tree nursery, but we had
you
one.
You had a tree nursery?
In Quincy.
And then I came here.
I could say I learned something because then I moved here and we cut down the tree nursery. So, you know.
So they had a tree nursery here too.
They did.
So what was the idea? Was it you took saplings or little trees and grew them to a certain height and then moved them and planted them?
Correct. In any gap there was.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, that was the system here. In Quincy, that really wasn't the system. They just wanted us to have trees because they just wanted us to have a nursery because they had so many silver maples. And, you know, every year you get storms and you'd lose, you know, 10 or 12. So they'd want us to plant 20. For those 10, you know, basically.
It's a crazy thing because for a long time, trees were considered like a sign of a country club. Like the public courses didn't have trees. Right. It was like a nice to have.
Yeah, I would agree.
So you came here, then it would have been 2000 or 2001?
2002.
2002.
January 1st.
Yeah. Okay. And, I mean, did you want to get back to Iowa? Was there, you know, or was it this job came up and, you know, it was...
Yeah, I was just starting to interview. I was in Quincy for 12 years, 10 as a superintendent. So it was time. I felt like my family was at the right stage of the game to move my kids. And, you know, I was getting to the point where I just didn't know where else I could go with that job. So I started interviewing at places, and actually I interviewed in Asheville, North Carolina. So I really didn't have, I wanted to go to a nice private country club and,
one without Bermuda
and one without Bermuda. So that was up in the mountains enough. You know, it was like 3,000 feet. That was good. It was all bad. Actually, they had Bermuda fairways and they wanted to move to Benton. So that's why they're interested in me. And then actually Cedar Rapids opened up right after that job. So yeah, I figured I was never, ever going to get this close to home.
Mm-hmm. So what in terms of you come to Cedar Rapids, and what's the first year, couple years like? Are you just kind of learning everything about the club? Like, how's the transition into a new club?
Yeah, so, you know, they really wanted to just, they were tired of it being green and lush and just heavily forested. You know, they wanted some better playability. They wanted to dry out. I was always a guy that pushed it to the edge. Even in Quincy, I push it way to the edge. So I think they really wanted better golfing conditions to start with. And then they really wanted to go into a restoration and start interviewing architects. So that really caught my interest too, because I like to keep, I'm a busy guy. I like to keep busy, especially with that kind of stuff. So I knew that the turf was, it was healthy. It was green. It was lush. I just needed to, you know, rework the programs, the maintenance programs, to where we could dry it out. And it was an educational process just to get the membership to understand we're not going to be green and lush anymore. And so, you know, I always said the brown's a new green. I didn't push it that hard, but they kind of wondered what route we were heading. So I had to do a lot of communication, I would say.
What were like the, agronomically, what were the toughest things that you faced coming in to play and trying to push to get to where you wanted it?
It was so lush. I mean, I don't know how much fertility he threw on. I really didn't have any records of his fertility, but I could not get the plant to stop growing. And so it was almost before, you know, the growth regulators were out, you know, the good ones anyway. So once I finally went through, you know, 3 years of no fertility on fairways, especially, we finally got them to thin out and lean up a little bit.
Like, was there a lot of thatch in it?
Thatchy.
Organic.
Yeah, so we had to go in and heavy aerification and then just slow the plant down.
When you're going through, what was heavier aerification schedule?
I mean,
like,
for us, it was twice a year, just heavy core aerification.
Big ones.
The big ones, you know, 3/4 to 7/8 inch tines. And then you just chop them up and blow everything off, you know. And so you just do that spring and fall is when we would do it.
And how many years did it take to get to a point where you really felt good about
where? I'd say by the fourth year, we had it pretty much under control. Uh-huh. And then we could start going into my own program as far as, you know, my heavy fertility of maybe a pound a year of nitrogen.
much. The local fertilizer rep probably was unhappy.
No, he was not happy.
It's the club in 2002 was pretty ahead of the curve for wanting that type of playing condition and looking at restoration. What would you say, would you attribute to that? And it's, you know, particularly surprising given, you know, somewhere right across, right next to our National Golf Links probably has a much higher chance to, you know, than, you know, in the central Iowa, where, you know, there's no landmark club to judge. Like, in many ways, Cedar Rapids is probably the landmark club that all courses around it look to.
Sure. I would say that had a really strong green committee at that time. They traveled well. They understood that we were the only Ross course in the state of Iowa. They thought that, I don't think they understood it to the way we did it this time, but, you know, this finally getting through the restoration, I don't think they were that far into it, but they understood that we needed to get back to that old Ross look, classic feel. And then they brought in Brad Klein he assessed the course in like 2000. I think he wrote a pretty strong report on what we could really be, which I think you know, probably got people interested anyway, for the most part. But to be honest, it was a Greens committee. Nobody else, the membership didn't understand.
Yeah.
They just felt like it's a Parkland setting. It's supposed to be soft and slow and it's beautiful. It's green. It's striped up real nice today. You know, they just didn't understand what it could be.
So talking through the early days, you come in, you inherit green course, very lush, probably lots of water put down on it, lots of trees. You start making changes. What was the initial reaction like?
Oh, we had some definite kickback. I mean, there was, you know, why aren't you watering? What, you know, we have an irrigation system. Then we put a new irrigation system in 2008, and they're like, you don't even use it. I mean, I said, well, it's just the way, I mean, think about how it's playing today. We're not killing the grass. I mean, it's, the turf's in great shape. I go, you can want it to be, you know, it was definitely, I had to improve the communication. There's no doubt about it. We sent out a lot of emails to explain what we were doing, because otherwise it just, and the problem is those same people don't read the emails or they don't want to understand it, you know? Mm-hmm. So they just, you know, and we removed all the flower beds, and I mean, they had a flower bed on every tee in the, coming out of the trees. I mean, it was interesting how they had, I mean, they had flowers planted in these holes on the side of trees. I mean, it's why it was like, so we ripped out the, you know, ripped those up.
And just in terms of those flower beds, yeah, I just moved into a house and we planted flowers and I had to take care of the flowers all summer. Like, it was not easy. Like, no. In terms of a maintenance crew, what, for flower beds, that's a lot of hours of maintenance over the course of a year, right?
Well, you have a full-time horticulturist. And then the flowers on top of that, you know, it's $75,000 a year just in labor and in the flowers itself. And I know it's beautiful. You know, we have around the clubhouse, it's beautiful right now, but we're doing it for, you know, $18,000 a year.
I mean, it's in the amount of work you could get done with that money on the golf course, which is why everybody joined here.
Exactly. Right?
Is, you know, it's just huge difference.
I would agree.
You sent out a lot of emails. Did you try anything else in terms of communication?
You know, did I just be around the membership? You know, I just try to make myself more visible, I guess, during those times anyway.
How did it start to change as you guys kept going and you got years into your work?
I think they just started to enjoy the golf course. Uh-huh. Like, wow, I'm hitting my drive 250 instead of 200. This is kind of crazy. You know, I feel like that's, The game changed for them a little bit. They started to enjoy it and see that, boy, it is making a difference. And then you get a rain, and, you know, the rain would green things up, but yet you wouldn't be flooded because of it being too wet. So, you know, as you dried things out, at least you could take an inch and a half of rain without any problem, because the water would just move right through. It wouldn't be already soggy from irrigation cycle after irrigation cycle after irrigation cycle.
I imagine that also getting people used to seeing grass that's not really green.
Absolutely.
Know, just where spots aren't perfect. It's just, you know, it's the almost like the gustification of things. And you guys then underwent doing, you know, the full blown renovation in what year was it?
2012 we approved the plan.
Approved the plan.
And then started in 13.
What was the process like that you guys went through in getting to that point before? That you were ready to pick an architect and the club was ready to jump in.
So we hosted town hall meetings to educate the membership. I'd say that was our number one communication, you know, and then just moving forward with we picked out three holes to start with that were the most visible from the clubhouse. So we started on 1, 4, and 10. And that way we figured that would make the biggest impact from the membership standpoint, and then they want to move forward. And I think we were correct in all of that.
Yeah. It started small. It wasn't, none of them were crazy changes either.
No.
Right? It's, you know, and it's like, you're kind of getting them comfortable with everything.
I agree.
So in terms of you guys, continue to work with Ron Pritchard and Tyler Ray. What was it about what they brought to the table versus, you know, the other architects that you looked at that you guys, that made you feel really comfortable?
I think they just, you know, Ron was very good when he came in for the presentation. Of course, his background was excellent. The courses we visited that he had finished were great from start to finish. Everybody we talked to at the clubs that he had finished or he had restored were very complimentary of Ron. And then Tyler, you know, just being able to work with Ron, I think it was just a win-win, you know, relationship for us. Mm-hmm. And we all felt good about the situation with Ron. And for a guy to come in and just give you his hand drawings, I mean, it's pretty cool, you know, in today's world.
It's really neat.
I mean, you're not going to get a lot of computer work out of him, but on his drawings were really cool, you know.
Uh-huh. So you guys went and visited some other Ross courses and did you do that with other architects that you looked at too?
We did not.
Okay.
We basically just went off, you know, I think they all drew a hole for us on what they visioned for a hole on the golf course and presented that to us. And then we ended up going with Ron.
Mm-hmm.
And so once we visited his courses, that's kind of where we ended up.
And you guys went about, you know, you see so many of the big name restoration renovations. Now you see the course is shut down for 2 years and you guys didn't shut down. You've done it over four years, roughly.
Yeah, it was a three year. But the roughest part was over 3 years.
So you did it over 3 years, and you know you did it for a dollar amount that you know most clubs would, you know, be amazed at. How did you guys do it for such a low cost? I mean, under $1 million to basically get a brand new golf course.
It was a lot of, you know, basically we started with Tyler being able to shape everything. And then my staff being able to be hands-on during the whole project. So we did it in the shoulder months of the season. And, you know, you had to have a membership that understood that, that were okay with it taking those 3 years. And also understanding that, you know, your maintenance levels are going to be lower because your number one priority is to get this project completed. So they were very supportive during it. So that helped tremendously. And then I think just having a staff that bought into it was enormous. I mean, I didn't lose anybody from that full-time staff. And really we worked about six guys on the project every day, all day. And then we'd have a few more on the golf course, you know, would they go out and mow greens and change cups and whatever. But you know, I was on the project the entire time myself. I mean, I dug every drainage line out there that there is to dig. I did it. I checked it myself. And so then the crew would follow me up with the tile and the rock. And, you know, I had a sod crew. Tim would run the sod crew, my assistant, you know, that would come in and sod the bunkers. And then we'd go in and put the sand in, you know, that was just one for just a bunker style project. That's how we would handle it.
So you're talking like you're getting four or five holes done a year, essentially.
Exactly.
And
I mean, the first year we did three, and then we really went after it the spring. And, you know, we went five and then nine. I mean, the last year we really went strong.
For the staff, it had to be so fun.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was definitely days. I mean, and we learned a lot through the project, just better ways to manage it and to be more productive than we were to start. So, you know, I remember the first day doing some shaping, and I said, oh, our dump truck will be able to haul all the dirt. You know, we don't need to have a trailer. And then when he got done carving around number one green, I'm like, we need two trailers. I mean, one dump truck's not going to be near enough. You know, it was little things like, I remember just driving up there after lunch and looking at the pile of dirt. And I'm like, oh my gosh, what are we going to do with this? So, you know, we had to kind of kick it up a notch on different pieces of equipment that worked out better. But
that sounds like when you're moving and you look and you're like, oh, we'll be done in like a couple hours.
Yeah,
and
right.
Then it's like 8 hours later and you're like, oh, I still got a bunch of stuff left. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
With bunkers, how'd you guys go about the process of like drainage and whether you're doing a liner or one of the new, you know, better Billy bunker or capillary?
So we didn't put liners in, being that they're just pretty much grass faced. They're all fescue around, all rhizoctomia is fescue around the outside edges. So, and with the flat bottoms, I decided we didn't really need a liner. So basically we just drained them and put sand in.
Put sand in. So it's just you just got drainage at the bottom and no liner.
Correct. And it's a local sand. It came from 30 miles away. So, you know, we paid like $18 a ton. And a lot of that was based on being in the floodplain. You know, I decided it's not worth when you have these bunkers flood to then you have to go in and replace the liners. You have to bring in sand from wherever you're bringing it in from, whether it's Pro Angle or, you know, some of these newer sands that they're using at these other courses. And I'm like, I just would rather be able to call and get, you know, 15 tons in if we need it.
I mean, probably a fifth of the price of some of those
sands. Oh, it was for sure. Yeah.
I mean, and then the other thing is it looks like a course from 1904.
Exactly. In fact, Ron even commented how it's almost a little too white for him. So, you know, Ron.
Well, weather, you know.
Right, that's
give,
right.
give it a summer and it'll change the color,
yeah,
right?
It will.
And it, so you just touched on flooding. Obviously, Iowa is a very, you know, floods happen here a lot. You know, you get these epic rainstorms and then you got this rolling terrain. With the golf course, what are flood events like, and what did you guys do during the renovation process to address and help some of your flood issues?
Oh, we installed all kinds of drainage and improved our drainage. And actually, a lot of the bunkers really sit in low areas to collect the water and then discharge through the drainage system. So, you know, Ron would always find these natural lows to put the bunkers in. And, you know, that would help when dewatering the golf course. And then we still have some swales to put in on a few of the fairways to help dewater also. But, you know, our typical water, if we get a 4.5-inch rain and we fill the bottom side fills up, because really we have about 10 holes that are affected by the floodplain or by flooding, you know, they'll dewater in a normal event within 24 hours and we'll be open for play in a couple of days.
I imagine one of the frustrating things from your standpoint with the flood, the low areas, is that the playing conditions, you've got the property, you've got this great, you know, dramatic rolling hills up at the top, then you go down to the low area in the riverbed.
Correct.
And those the holes up top probably play so much differently after rain events than the bottom ones.
They do. In fact, but over the years, you know, there's been so much sand that has been brought in from the creek that actually those bottom fairways have been top dressed so much that
they actually
play pretty firm even after the water. I mean, it's amazing how dry those fairways can get down there. Now they will get localized a lot because of all the sand, but they get naturally top dressed every year.
What do you mean by localized?
So, you know, basically when you get real dry, you'll get these localized dry areas that just happen. And a lot of it's because of sand top dressing.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you have to go in and aerify them and try to get some weighing agents on them to help push water through those profiles.
I gotcha. That's, the natural, it's almost like the floods bring stuff that's good for the
most part. And it changes, you know, over the years. You know, it's amazing how we put this new irrigation system in, or put the irrigation system in 2008, and some of the heads now are maybe 2 inches below the surface because of just the sand and silt over the top.
That's crazy.
And you can try to sweep that all you want off, but you can never get to it.
How has that affected, like, approaches into greens at all?
Not as much as I've noticed, because most of the greens are elevated enough to where it doesn't affect the approach. But it has affected areas along the creek, and it will affect your normal drainage swales too, you know, that help dewater. I mean, those will get kind of filled up, so you have to make sure to grade those back out the way they were.
Mm-hmm. And I bet the way different ways water move have changed a little bit, right?
Oh, for sure. Uh-huh. Yeah.
That's drainage is...
It's really unbelievable. I mean, you wish you could just... You know, you wish you could have a year to where you could just take a dozer and just create some nice drainage area, you know, swales and areas to where you know water sits, and not have to worry about putting the turf right back on, you know, just to help dewater.
You guys have done some of those.
We have.
Talk a little bit about the decision to do those. And I feel like so many clubs are afraid to do something like a area, like a ditch or a area that you takes the water on.
Yeah. So in between 7 and 11, we did that. You know, 7 used to be real wet, a wet fairway anyway, and it had a pond, but then that's all it really had. So we eliminated the pond and created this big lull that goes all the way back to the creek. And basically it's set up for when the water rises, it will fill in, but then it will flow out when the creek goes back down, but the fairway stays dry. Mm-hmm. So that was a whole objective of that. And we have more of that to do.
And it's worked really well.
It has.
So you in the future, that's, you know, I was on my list here. I've got with that ongoing work. You guys are going to continue to add more and more of those.
We are.
It's, and then for most of the year, 90% of the year, it's just a rough area.
Just a, yeah, exactly.
And for, you know, there's so many places with flood concerns, especially I think about local municipal golf where I'm from, and every single golf course was built in a floodplain. And when there's big rain, all of them flood.
Yeah.
And it's like none of them have anywhere that takes on the water, though, you know.
If you can create those areas, I would highly recommend it. And every area of the golf course doesn't have to be perfect. I mean, it doesn't have to be manicured perfect. You can make those areas waste areas. You know, you can still play out of them. It's just, I feel like when you don't do it, water just sits everywhere that it's not supposed to, or that you don't want it to.
It's been more effective than the pond was.
Absolutely.
Why?
Because it can flow out.
Okay.
You know, the pond will still hold the water. And as the pond raises up and gets flooded, it's, you know, nothing can drain into it. So as the, even though the creek will go down, the pond doesn't go down near as fast. And so now it can dewater out into the creek versus be stuck into the pond.
Could you build more ways to get water into it also?
You could, for sure.
That makes, because like with a pond, you can't have it. You could, there's only so much earthwork you could do around it, right?
Exactly.
Interesting. That's a lot of places probably could use some,
yeah,
of those.
And we could use more of it also.
Uh-huh. So outside of that, what else are you're, you know, ongoing work? I imagine every time you take a walk, you see 7 more things you want to do.
I mean, we still have some fairways to tie in. We still have, you know, bunker edges, some fairways to tie into the bunkers where maybe we, you know, we put the fescue around the edge, the leading edge going into the fairway, but we're going to, you know, reduce that and make that bent grass going into them. Still have some trees here and there to remove just to help open up some vistas and just for lines of play. We have a bridge to replace. It's just a maintenance bridge. It's just unsightly on number 17. That kind of takes away your view from the fairway to the green that we need to move upstream. You know, still some cart path removal. You know, we really haven't seen, you know, for anybody out there that's scared of removing cart paths, really haven't seen much damage from removing the cart paths.
And you get a lot of rain. You know?
And we've had 2 of the wettest years on record. So, I mean, I just like them to scatter and drive wherever they want to, basically. I think it helps. And they stay away from the greens and tees, but, you know, we still have some cart path removal. You know, just little things. It's really a lot of minor things that we have yet to do.
Mm-hmm. What, in terms of the club, since you guys have done all this work, you know, the golf course has kind of undergone this transformation. Have you seen a culture change with the people around the club? Do they understand more of what you're doing than, say, when you started in 2002?
Oh, for sure. I think especially in the last few years, they're seeing more and more of the changes that have made a huge difference. You know, we have seen actually scores go down from the member tee than they were prior to the restoration. So that helps. I think just the, you know, the highlights of where we stand today versus where we stood in 2002, from ratings and whatnot. I think, you know, people are really proud to be a member here.
Have you seen anything from like the way they take care of the course? Are they more mindful of divots or ball marks, or is there more walking, or is there same amount of cart traffic as you used to have?
I'd say that I would say it, they've always been really good about taking care of the golf course. Yeah, you're always going to have, they get more upset if you have an outing, which we don't, thankfully we don't have a lot anymore. But they'd be upset if we had an outing and they didn't put their, you know, that's when you notice your divots aren't being replaced and your ball marks aren't being fixed. But from a membership standpoint, they've always been really good about taking care of it. As far as cart traffic goes, I'd say more people walk. But we have moved into a little younger member movement as far as age goes, to where, you know, I like to ride and have a good time. So, you know,
it's interesting that you would think that should be the opposite way, younger members more walking, right?
Yeah, right. Yeah, it just doesn't fit them.
That's kind of ironic.
I think they, you know, they like to get out and have a good time, and they like to get around, and you know, especially, you know, we have like a Wednesday night men's league that likes to have fun, and so they like to get as much golf as they can in 3 hours. So, you know, that's fun.
No, I agree. Late night trying to squeeze in holes. I think we've all enjoyed the speed and the which a cart can get you around.
Exactly.
in terms that you mentioned something about you do less outings than you used to do. Was that like a conscious decision by the club, or?
Yeah, you know, I think we were just trying to keep it open for membership play. You know, it's less wear and tear. And I personally feel that, I mean, if you're having 6 or 8 or 10 outings in town from, you know, in town businesses, that it's limits maybe your membership just because they can come out and play 10 times, you know? So I feel like make it a little more exclusive, maybe creates a little better membership.
Would a lot of those happen on Mondays?
Exactly.
And that obviously limits what you can do.
Correct. It does take away from our maintenance, because we are closed till noon on Mondays for maintenance.
So your members can play afternoon?
Afternoon they can.
Uh-huh. Is that always been the case, or was that?
That has been.
Okay. Yeah. But that whole, given that half a day even without any play.
It's beautiful. I mean, you know, that's when we top dress, that's when we spray, and that's getting ahead of the crowd. You know, and Mondays have gotten slower, become slower just because of that. We'll get people after 3 maybe, but you know, they know that we're out there doing our thing. Mm-hmm. So they don't get out there too early on Monday afternoon.
That's good. So in terms of Cedar Rapids, you know, the trees, obviously, when you look at the before and after, it's a very shocking change. How did you get all the trees down and removed for low cost? Because I think that's obviously one of the big barriers is cost.
It is. I had a really good assistant that wasn't afraid to cut down a tree, and his back was about 4 feet wide. But I contracted out a lot of stuff around the greens, but everything basically from tee to green, we did most of it in-house. And so he was just got really good at it. And so, you know, we'd rent a chipper. We were fortunate to have a company in town that, there are members that really helped us out through the whole process. And so they, you know, they've always taken care of us on those type of things. And so we could rent a chipper, and we had the saws, and we have a stump grubber from 1969. So it still runs. So, I mean, it's amazing they even had a stump grubber back in 1969, because all they did was plant trees. But anyway, it was never that big of a deal, I don't think. I mean, you could always see what the end product was going to be. So we went after it, and it was a lot of the trees were just planted over the years. And so they had no reason to even be planted where they were planted. It was an arborist that worked for the club that they would just bring in 200 trees every year. And he would just be told to go fill in spots. And so there was actually no rhyme or reason for doing it.
You've taken out a ton of trees. There's still a ton of trees. I mean, you guys have so many great majestic oaks. It would be absolutely, and that's like the thing. You're just the trees that are great trees are now more and more exposed, right?
Oh, now they can mature properly. You know, they never had any air, never any light to really grow the way they were meant to grow. And so all these trees were just planted in amongst all the beautiful oaks. You couldn't even see them before.
That's the thing I think people get misconstrued so much, is like when you talk about tree management, it's not just clear cutting all the trees. It's allowing the great trees that have matured and that are indigenous to the area to shine, you know?
I would agree 100%. I mean, that's what we did. We would just specify which trees we needed to keep. Mm-hmm. I mean, which were the highlighted trees, and we'd keep those and then cut down the junk around them, basically.
Yeah. Was there a moment when, I mean, you've been working here for a long time, you're taking down trees, and you uncovered something that you didn't even realize. Like, were you shocked at how much the transformation changed the way you look at the golf course and property?
Oh, for sure. I mean, you vision it at first, and I think really when we started and finished 1-4-10, you saw kind of what you could really have. But until maybe the last 3 years, 4 years, it's really shined, and you become so proud of what you never would have realized it.
You open up those great long views, and then the stars, that topography that you just don't, you know, see it at a lot of places. It's like kind of the unique trait, characteristic you got here is this unbelievable setting. And, you know, if it's not showing, you know.
Right. And I mean, I could tell you right now in 2005, 2004, I didn't take any pictures out here. I mean, now I can't go out here in the morning and not take a picture. I mean, it's like, it's just so beautiful. I mean, taking photos from every angle, and in the evenings, it's beautiful. You know, as the sun's going down, it's just, and you get so many great photos now.
Yeah. I imagine, I don't know, obviously you're not playing with the membership, but there is a much more sense of intimacy on the golf course as well. Like where you're kind of in amongst every, you know, like you're not cornered off all exactly. The time, and also you can see what's going around you. You can see who's out on the golf course, and it's a club. It's a social gathering spot.
Yeah, I hear guys, you know, I'll hear guys from 5 green yelling at guys on 9 coming up, you know, where are you at? Where do you stand? You know, it creates a great game, you know, the conversation. And, you know, before it was just, you know, line up every fairway with trees and try to isolate every hole. And it just created, I don't know, it's a whole different deal.
I wonder, you probably could find some cool pictures of, like, I don't know, I imagine a lot of people watch the club championship out here.
Oh, sure.
It's like the club championship in 2004, like with all the carts and everybody out there watching versus, like, you know, today.
Oh, I like, you're like our member guests. It's just crazy when you see all the carts everywhere and people flowing everywhere. And it's, you can get pictures from, you know, the top of 2 or, you know, down on 3T, and you can go all the way across to 5 and 14. You see people everywhere. Or mm-hmm. I can go outside our shop on 10 and take pictures across 13 and 18 and 15 and see just traffic everywhere. You know, I mean, it's so cool.
It just exposes the scale of the place much more too, because you see people climbing these big hills, right?
Exactly,
to these greens, and you see the long view of how this landform just like flows into the green. It's just, that's the cool thing that tree removal does. Yeah. Is it just,
and it opens it up, and it creates, I mean, honestly, I think it even creates different shots because of the wind, you know, that they never had to deal with before, because now the trees are, you know, minimized so much that they don't have that issue with the shade and the cover of the tree, you know.
Agronomically, obviously, it had to make a big
difference. Oh, unbelievable. Yeah.
It's, you know, is there any green in particular that went from being essentially like brutal to grow grass on that now is like one of your best ones?
I'd say, you know, 2-4, 2-4, 10, those were our worst greens. Number one. 16. I mean, those greens were our worst greens. I remember them coming out of winter, and they'd hold water, you know, water would run over the top of them. I mean, it was, you know, they'd have all kinds of ice damage and water damage.
A lot less ice damage now.
No water, really, water doesn't sit on them anymore.
I imagine that the weather swing here is one of the most severe, you know,
yeah,
in terms of heat and cold.
And it's especially, you know, we go from 60 degrees to, you know, last week we were below zero. So it's, and especially with old bent poa greens like we have, you know, they're old perennial type of bent or a poa. So, you know, the poa has adapted over the years to that environment. So
you've done a lot of expansions. How have you gone about grassing the greens?
So the expansions were basically just core them out, and then we just use plugs from the green to expand them out. Like the right side 13, we expand that out quite a bit. And so we just stripped it, and added sand, and then just threw cores in on the right hand side, so it was all the same grass.
So like cores from the
existing green.
Okay, from the aerification.
Exactly.
And you just throw the plugs over there.
Right over there.
Just not. I hear a lot of people do that and grow a nursery from that. Yep. But you just threw it into the.
I just dumped them right over there from that green.
How long did that take to have?
We did it in the fall, and it was open that spring.
And you sent the same grass
from same exact grass.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it's you never know what you even added onto it. It's so much better than buying bent grass and putting it into an old bent green.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it should. I mean, we would always use cores. We did the same thing on 5. We expanded that back left corner. We did the same thing with that.
That's neat. So thanks for coming on.
Well, thanks for coming to Cedar Rapids.
Oh yeah, I mean, my pleasure. It's not that far from Chicago.
Hey, come in the summer next time.
I'm going to. I've got myself booked up a couple times on the road this way. So yeah,
perfect.
You might see me too much now.
Awesome.
You
know, that'd
that's
be
the
great.
Problem. You're gonna say, "I gotta get rid of this guy."
Hey, but, you're always welcome, Andy.
Yeah, thanks. People can find you on Twitter.
They can. Absolutely.
Your handle at Tom Feller?
At CRCC Soup.
CRCC Soup. I knew that. Yeah. I got to write that down on my notes.
SUP.
Are you on Instagram?
You know, let's not get crazy.
Yeah.
Twitter's tough enough.
You can pass less in knowledge on and information on in Instagram. It's more just pretty pictures.
Exactly.
You know,
right.
The Twitter's where the
Twitter's
where the
good
nuts
enough
and
for me right
are.
Now. Yeah.
All right. Thanks so
Enjoyed
much
it.
For coming.
Thank you. Yep.